President Trump in 2026 is facing two wars, the Iran war and the war he's supporting in Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia. He is losing two wars, and all evidence suggests he will lose them both. That will have profound implications for the international arena, for international security, for American national security and regional security in both the Middle East and in Europe. Potentially profound changes. And so many people are focused so much on the nuances of what's happening today. And obviously we cover that in both of these wars to keep people up to date. But I thought it was useful today. In fact, I think it's very important that at this point that we zoom back and recognize there are some major fault lines we're heading right towards. And if we don't make some better decisions in between now and the time when these wars, the conclusion, manifest themselves against anyone's desires, we better think about this before we do it, so that, if theoretically anyway, we can make some better decisions in between now and then, potentially move past and avoid some of these worst outcomes. That's ideal. Right now, I'll just say, doesn't look very promising that we're going to, but it's important that you know what we're headed towards and what the consequences are if we don't make these changes. And we have nobody better to do that today than we have our good friend Alistair Crookback, who is a geopolitical commentator, host of the conflictsforum.substack.com, which we refer to a lot. Alistair, first of all, welcome back. Always a delight to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to join you.
Well, look, let's take these in order, and we'll start off, first of all, with the war in Iran. And I think a good bit of the reason can be encapsulated in this one soundbite here from a Senator Daines, who was asked an honest question by Fox News. He asked, hey, are we going into another forever war?
You worried that maybe we're in a forever war again?
Nobody wants to end this conflict more than President Trump. He's executing a war at the moment to protect our children and grandchildren, to ensure this dangerous regime never has nuclear weapons, the ability to take the world to its knees. President Trump is working hard, but there's only one position that the Iranians respect, and that's the position of strength. They will get to a continued weakened posture, and I hope that will yield an outcome. A negotiated settlement would be the best outcome. But President Trump knows it is about peace through strength. He'll have relentless force used against this corrupt, evil regime until they are taken to their knees.
Okay, a lot to unwind there, but Iran's just corrupt, evil regime, so I don't know how you can negotiate with them. But whatever, we still need negotiations. But hang on, we had a negotiated deal with the MOU that was supposed to pave the way for those very end of war negotiations, and we messed those up after 1 week by inserting something into paragraph 5 about the Strait of Hormuz. How do you see, first of all, just the framing that the mainstream America, especially this Republican party with the Senate right there, how do you view that as compared to the reality?
Well, I mean, I think that opens a really important question, the piece that you've just, the clip that you've just shown. Because really, first of all, I mean, we have to look back and see what America is or what it stands for. But America was originally founded on, if you like, the ideals of a reform of the world, of that America is a light to the nations. It was going to be the new Israel, that it was the city on the hill, that it was almost a redemptive message, slightly messianic even, because it was, as America has this mission to change the world and to take it forward and to give it democracy and liberal values, etc. And that was implanted, I think, mostly by sort of the Protestant people who came to America, this idea of it. After all, a lot of it came out of the English Civil War, Cromwell's War, and the very strong Puritan in the strong sense of Old Testament redemption that was present in England at this time. And somewhere along the line, and I'm not quite sure when, this changed in America. And now what you described and what you see and what we hear from America is Manichaeanism, not liberalism, not the sense of, you know, a redemption, and that we're all going to move on to new values and the world is going to come together in some wonderful, wonderful new shape. No, what we see, and we saw it, and it's not just Trump, and it's therefore not just, you know, his influence on the Republican Party. We saw it with Biden. You remember the speech in front of Liberty Hall. I think he did it in front of Liberty Hall, the famous site, with cloaked in a sort of deep red hue of lighting. And it was all about not a future, a vision of the future. It was all about evil, good and evil. Putin is evil. Russia is evil. These are evil people. And we are the light. We are the good. And they are the bad. And they must be defeated. And that was really, I think it was in Prague or he first said it. And then in front of the Liberty Hall, I mean, there was a clear shift. And it's a very disconcerting shift, because America has moved into this Manichaean vein, which you saw in that clip that you just put on the show. Because, you know, if you take this Manichaean view, there are two implications. First of all, there can be no negotiated settlement, because, you know, you go back to Karl Strauss and you go back to Leo Strauss and all of that. I mean, they were very clear. They were at the Chicago University, I think, and very influential people. But Karl Strauss made it clear. I mean, you have to blacken your adversaries so much that the idea of talking to them, negotiating with them, would be for you to fall to evil, you to become contaminated. And therefore, you can't negotiate. How do you negotiate with evil? You can't, is the answer that was coming out then. And this was deliberately, I think, implanted at that time by Strauss and other thinkers, and then has become sort of fixed. But there are more than that, because if you take that view, you know, that is, you know, it's impossible to talk with these people, which we saw, of course, during the war on terror. 9/11, I think, was the turning point, because then, you know, these people, as it was always called, you can't listen to, you can't talk to, you can't hear anything from Hezbollah or from any of these movements. They have to be just defeated. But then there is a second implication, and darker implication. I mean, if you can't negotiate, and it's just impossible to deal with this sort of evil, then, of course, the path to using weapons of mass destruction becomes much more open and much more prominent in thinking. And so it's very dangerous, this way of thinking. I remember taking people, I was in Canada, and I was giving a talk. When I gave the talk, in the background, there was orchestra playing music for the audience and everything, and they were listening to the talk. And I was giving a talk to sort of businessmen in Canada. And at the end of the talk, I turned around and said, I don't know if you realize, but you've been listening to the Hezbollah orchestra, all in their tails, black coats, and playing Tchaikovsky. And you say you can't talk to these people? How can they be playing Tchaikovsky and you cannot find a word to say to them? But that's where we ended up with that period. And that's where it seems to me, when you know, Fox News are putting out statements, like I think it was on Fox News, yes, were putting out sort of comments of the sort, you know, these people are evil, you can't deal with them. Actually, the converse, they've got, I don't know, people say, I was reading a little bit of Maggie Habermann's view, I think she was on your program, maybe, of her new book, Regime Change, with her and Swan. And she says in this, a couple of things. One was, in her view, Trump has always, for years, decades, had this animus against Iranians for reasons that no one seems really to know, but that, of course, they've been sort of animated in this period. And I think that she was also suggesting in this that Trump has become in his second term much more instinctive, and he relies on his instincts rather, and the range of people that talk to him has become narrower and narrower. His bunker has shrunk, if you like, to a few people that talk to him in this way. But this is why I'm saying America has got this back to front. I just want to be very blunt with you. You have got this back to front. The narrative that Trump expounds and others is that there are these terrible hardliners in government in Iran, these people in the IRGC, the head of the IRGC. These are the hardliners that disrespect their people, and they don't take account that people, are suffering and want to have a solution. This is the narrative. You got it back to front. Actually, it is the people, Iranian young people, who are rejecting negotiation, and they want vengeance, and they call regularly for vengeance against America. And it is the so-called hardliners who are, if you look them up, try looking them up on Google, the people that we all know, the names that we know, you'll find all of them have got degrees, they've got PhDs, they've got 3 PhDs in philosophy and technical subjects in math. They're some of the most educated people. Larijani, before he was killed, as an example, was a philosopher, and he was an authority on Islamic philosophy going back to just over 1,000 years. But also he was a philosopher dealing with Habermas and other contemporary Western philosophers. And the understanding, they've got it back to front. And no wonder then, this is going to fail, and this is going to be a complete disaster, because it's not the leaders that are hardliners that won't bend to Trump's will. It's actually the opposite. The people fear that they might bend to Trump's will, and so are trying to stiffen their spine by saying, we want revenge, not at talks. And they're very caustic now about people who have in the past advocated for negotiations. So, yes, the whole structure has put, the idea of a solution, diplomatic solution, is now impossible.
And so that's actually why I guess my premise is, you've just laid it out so articulately that you have both the United States with President Trump basically laying a foundation where we can't negotiate with them in terms of genuine negotiations, meaning I'm going to give something to get something. No, we just want them to surrender, and that's the only real way we're looking at it. And now then you're showing that the Iranian side has its own hardened position, and the will of the people, which is more important than just the leaders, it's the will of the people, which sets up a situation to where you're not going to get a negotiated settlement. And to my eyes and my military mind, that means we're going to lose, because we don't have the military means to compel compliance of the Iranian side. So I think that eventually, and we've talked about this many times before, but the bottom line is, I argue that it's very clear that we cannot win this war, and therefore all we can do is to lose. So given, if that be true, and until it actually happens, it can never be sure. But what I'd like to ask you here in the next few minutes is a number of questions about what the ramifications of an American loss would look like. And let's take them in piece here. Let's first of all look for Iran. So based on where Iran was on the 27th of February, the day before this war started, and where do you think they will end up on the backside of whatever a resolution looks like?
Well, I think the resolution that the only resolution that really is available is that Trump will at some point have to acknowledge that Hormuz is in the power and the possession of Iran, and that they will charge fees for passage through what is not international waters, but the territorial waters of Iran, and that the other waters will, corridors will not be allowed. So I think this will be the resolution. And ultimately, yes, I think that Gulf states who are, say they won't accept this at the moment, they won't have much alternative. And they will have to accept it. And the prospects facing them are quite dark because, you know, this is also going to end, you know, the petrodollar economy that has brought us all these sort of gleaming high skyscraper buildings in the Gulf states. That whole architecture has to go, will go. It was based on the petrodollar. It was entirely based on, after 73 and the huge increase in the price of oil, something we're seeing a little bit of now. But at that point, the United States encouraged the Gulf states, you know, to deal in this, providing that they traded in dollars and remitted all of their savings back to the United States. And that was the fuel for, if you like, the financialized economy that then broke out in the United States and became even more implanted after 2008 great financial crisis. So, I mean, and this is a completely different economy from, you know, a real economy. This is what I call a casino economy. It's all about insider trading. It's all about the margins. It's arbitrage between the morning and afternoon rates, between what are happening in Japan today and what's happening in Japan tomorrow. I mean, it produces nothing except huge wealth for the oligarchy. This is, you know, there is no support for that continuing overall, I mean, in the non-West. They want and would like, and Iran wants the Gulf to go back to real economy, something that provides for the people, that provides things and food and whatever their needs and has to produce that. I think that eventually, so you ask me what it's going to look like, Iran will be a prominent, if not a dominant power in the Middle East, and Gulf states will either come to terms with us and change, or they will disappear. And it will be a different Middle East, and that will repercuss across widely the region. And what is missing from this instinctive analysis in the White House is the other point about what he's brought about and what the White House has brought about, because it doesn't really get through in the Western press much, but the war is spreading. It's widening. It's not that. It's not just Yemen. It's not just Lebanon. It is not just Syria. It is now Iraq. The Iranians are attacking Kurds that are inside Iraq. The Iraqi government have given the Hashad an order to disarm by the 30th of September, just as Trump has tried to organize a system by which Hezbollah is forced to disarm and Israel to stay and choose when it leaves, if it leaves Lebanon. And then you have that, you have Yemen, you have Gaza, you have inside the Green Line. Everything is in a state of disruption. Everything is tense. And the point I'm making here is there's no single solution when all these other equations come in. What solves the, if you like, the equation with Iran will not necessarily solve the equation between the Yemenis and Saudi Arabia, who are now seemingly entering an open war between the two. the equation between Iran and Trump will not solve the question of the Hashad and the Iraqi situation. The equation between Iran and Trump will not resolve the situation of Shara in Syria and his relationship with Lebanon that US is trying to turn into some sort of attack on Hezbollah through the neighboring Shi'i villages that lie just on the borders between Lebanon and Syria. So now everything is interrelated, but also has its separate agendas. I mean, this is a headache. Even a chess player would be thinking, oh my God, how do I put all of that together into a single composite? That's because it's been allowed to go further and further and extend to more and more as Israel tried to take advantages in Lebanon and Syria and elsewhere. And as it tried to get its own advantages, it's pulled Trump into this quagmire of different conflicts, all of which are connected. The Iran one is at the heart of it, but they all have separate agendas. They won't be settled simply by saying, oh, new ceasefire. We're proposing a ceasefire with Iran. That's not going to settle the Yemeni siege for siege war on Saudi Arabia. The Yemenis now, at this moment, because of the moment, have decided that this is the time to kick the Saudis out of the region. I don't know. That doesn't mean they'll succeed in it or whatever. But this just means that the whole thing has become so complicated and will stay complicated.
And how man, you know, given that whole panoply of fires that are burning and independent fuel sources for each one of them, which I argue were, if not all started by the February 28th war that we saw, they certainly got put extra fuel into. But now then they can't. There's not one solution, as you just are artfully described here. But then what can be a resolution here? How will these fires burn out? And we'll look separately at the Israel. I don't want to miss that part here because that's a very important component, how that's going to come out. But right now it seems to me that the order that existed even nominally on the 26th of February before this war started off is gone forever. Not just the Iranians going to be in control of the Strait of Hormuz forever, because they said they will under no circumstances ever give that up. But then everything else goes along with that. And what about the United States? Let me ask that specifically here. You've talked about the GCC and the Iranian side. What about America and the Middle East? How is that after this all ends by whatever means?
Well, I think the most important, there are two important things. One is that this war is shredding the standing of the U.S., if you like, military presence. It's, you know, it was sought to be invulnerable. It was sought to be, you know, could not be contested. It could not be attacked. And that has all been proved wrong. And that the American has got its American military structures, have its Achilles heel. They don't have enough defense weapons. They don't have enough wherewithal to launch a major war. And they're not doing very well, even with a localized war, making mistakes. But let me just come to the big question. You know, the price is going to be very high. Because you remember in 79, the question of the hostages. The hostages were held at the embassy, and it brought down Carter and his administration. Well, there aren't any students in an embassy, but there is something called the Fifth Fleet. Where is that? Off Bahrain, I believe. That's quite a big hostage, is it not? It's not really it's not allowed to come out in public expression, but effectively the Fifth Fleet is an Iranian hostage. So, you know, I mean, someone better wise up, I think, in the White House and say, you know, we just have to get out of this, and we have to get out of this quite quickly. Otherwise, this is going to become a complete catastrophe for the United States, for its image, for its presence in the world. It will be a humiliation. So I think that is the only way out. But the problem with us is, as Maggie Haberman, I know she doesn't get on very well with Trump and so on, but I mean, as she points out, you know, his psyche is changed in the second round. It is a psyche that is, you know, that he believes he's sort of far more powerful, that he is an imperial leader, and that he can get what he wants and do what he wants, and he doesn't have to care about norms or laws or anything like this. And he admires ruthlessness. He made this comment, I think, paradoxically about Netanyahu, that, you know, oh yes, there might have been problems with him, but you know, Netanyahu, he's not afraid of war. And obviously that statement appealed deeply to Trump. Well, Trump has got his war. But, you know, wars are not always just like Venezuela. I mean, it won't be, right. It's not going to be like that. So, you know, they have to think really hard. And this is the balance that the United States faces, I believe. I'm speaking very frankly, but I think honestly to you, is that on one hand, he has the choice of climbing down from the tree, which psychologically, I admit, is going to be, I don't know if it's possible, but that is one possibility. The other one is to go to all-out war. And I think that that is going to finish the standing of the United States as being considered either as a serious political player or a serious military power. Because people will have seen and learned lessons from the Iranian experience of how to deal with the United States. And the first lesson that they've learned is to trust in nothing. Nothing said, nothing written, nothing. It's best not to. That's why the young people on the streets of Iran say, "Are you negotiating?" You know, he'll say one thing one moment and then he'll pull it back the next moment. So there's no point talking to a person like that. Forget it. We don't need to deal with the United States.
I think you can add another point to that. The other lesson that seems to have been learned is that not only can you not trust anything that our country says, but if you punch us in the face, we can't deal with those blows. We can't stop them. And exactly. As you said, we're more vulnerable than people thought. Now, given that, what then does that mean for Israel? Because that's always been at the heart of all this for many in America anyway, is that, oh, we have to support Israel, whatever. But now then, if what you described with the United States manifests and, you know, the Sixth Fleet headquarters in Bahrain is now can't even go out, we end up, if we spall, especially if we try the all-out war, we're going to fail. We're not going to succeed. And now then, we're not going to be able to protect Israel. So now Israel, at the moment, is fighting Hamas. They're fighting settlers in the West Bank. Sometimes they're fighting Yemen. Sometimes they're fighting in Syria. Sometimes they're fighting in Lebanon. And then now they potentially could go back to fighting in Iran. Can they fight this seven-front war without America?
No, absolutely not. And they know that. And that's why you had the chief of staff, military chief of staff, went to the cabinet about 2 weeks ago, and he said, I want to flash a red flashing light to you, members of the cabinet. The IDF is on the point of collapse. We don't have people. It's breaking down. Morale is dissipating. And he said, we would need not just one IDF, but seven or eight of the IDFs that exist now to manage what you've set for us, which you started after the 7th of October, when you changed the security doctrine from the Ben-Gurion security doctrine to that of the greater Israel security doctrine, the greater, the permanent security, security at the root, preemptive security against any threat that may rise up. The intent is sufficient for us to have to militarily erase it and destroy it. And he was very tough. And there have been others in former generals like Brick, General Brick. He's now retired, but he's well known. He was someone that, in fact, Netanyahu sought advice from. So he's not an outlier. And he says, if things go on like this, there'll be civil war in Israel. Because, you know, everyone understands. They do. I mean, they can't come to terms with it, but they do understand that everything that had been claimed of the war in Iran, Israel's war in Iran, have failed. There's been no change in the government. They have not defeated the missiles. They have not ended, if you like, enrichment of uranium by the Iranians. None of the things have been achieved. Nothing at all. In fact, the converse. And this is said by Israelis, not me, but Iran has emerged the stronger as a result of this war, not weaker. It's pulled together society. It's brought cohesion to society. That people support the government, they support the Islamic State more than ever. And so, you know, the question is, then what is Israel going to do? And you know, as a military man, I mean, you're spread out across the whole of, well, nearly the whole of Greater Israel. They haven't got some parts of it yet, but they're on that way in Gaza and the West Bank, but beyond that into Syria and so on. What are you going to do? I mean, you can't permanent war forever. Is that going to be what is offered to the Israeli to kill anyone? I mean, this is the reason why, you know, they cannot even come to a solution or support the MOU, because they will never agree to Hezbollah remaining, because it's contrary to their doctrine that came out of the 7th of October, that Israel is always on the threshold of a Holocaust. And, you know, Hezbollah threatens Holocaust to the northern territories. It doesn't threaten Holocaust. It threatens Israel when it attacks Lebanon or invades Lebanon. That is what caused the formation of Hezbollah, was the invasion of Lebanon 20 years ago, long time ago. But they drove out Israel from Lebanon, and the Israelis can't get over it. And so therefore, they regard this as a Holocaust. They regard 7th of October as a Holocaust, which it wasn't. But they do see it in these terms, and they believe in it psychologically. So, I mean, you know, so how are you going to get Israel back on tracks? How are you going to sort of bring it back to Ben-Gurion, who said, we are a small state. We don't have the means for a big army. We can't do all this. We have to stay within the limitations of our borders, and we have to rely on reservists. That's how it is. Get used to it. And of course, you know, Netanyahu has broken that completely and expanded everywhere with all these wars, and now facing off against Turkey in Syria. I mean, you know, yes, it's just inconceivable. It can't continue like this. Yet they cannot see what to do, and this is the dilemma. The Zionist sort of model that has as amended by Netanyahu and others has become untenable. The vision has become impossible. So, but they cannot offer an alternative. They don't know. And so Netanyahu is going into elections. The moment the polls show, he'll lose. And this means that he is desperate to find a solution. So he's urging America on. Destroy Iran, to try and revive his message to the Israeli people that, you know, he saved them from the bomb and that it was his efforts that brought Trump into this war. That's probably the only truth in his statement, but it's not very encouraging for Israelis. So it looks as if he's preparing to refuse to accept defeat in the elections. I mean, the Likud, his party, the other day had this grand meeting. They call it a Supreme Court. It's not. It's just an internal Likud meeting. And at that meeting, he said and got approval that if there was any security threat at all, he mentioned Iran, any security threat, he was free to cancel elections.
Wow.
And on top of that, he demanded and got that he would nominate every candidate if there were elections. Alone, no primaries, no elections. He, Netanyahu, would nominate, I mean, together with Sarah, of course, would nominate whoever would be put up by the Likud in elections. So he's preparing. You'd have two states now moving in this direction, it seems to me. You have Israel on one hand as the sort of pathfinder state, looking at how to manage the whole process. He's already said, well, you know, the real Supreme Court rulings don't apply. We're not going to obey them. And increasingly, you have in the United States, not quite the same because the situation is different, but you also have a president that is saying, well, you know, we're going to have to change the ways votings happen, and we're going to have to make sure that everything, everyone has citizenship, and we're going to have to look at separate states. So we have both of them moving towards this path where they may be trapped into a situation where they will say that they cannot accept the electoral result.
Yeah, that's just going to cause more chaos domestically in both of those countries, which will just add more fuel to the fire of potential civil war.
And which will affect, because don't forget, the Israeli election is in October and the midterms are a month later in November.
Right.
So, I mean, there's going to be an interchange on that. One is going to affect the other, and the other is going to affect Israel. Go on.
I'm sorry. Last question I want to ask on this section here is, let's look outside the region, though, because nothing happens in a vacuum. What would you say would be the ramifications, if there were any significant ones, for China? If all of this situation you just described, where we can't win a war and there's chaos that's reigning there, Iran comes out stronger, Israel weaker, and the Americans maybe even out. What does that do to China?
I think it first of all, it strengthens the BRICS because they can see a weakening America, and that the if America's failed within to subordinate Iran and reduce it to a vassal, then it won't succeed with either Russia or China. So those states will take encouragement from Iran winning the war, very much so. And it will increase, of course, China's insistence to try and have a close relationship with Iran to secure their oil supply. I mean, China is only dependent, I think it's 7% on oil from the Middle East, but it's because China is such a big user of oil. It's still amongst to a lot of oil. So they are very concerned about the security of their energy supplies. And that's why they'll be very worried about what Trump's doing in Iraq, because China also gets supplies, being closely involved in the Iraqi fields. And if these fields are going to be, if you like, Americanized in some way by this new prime minister that Trump is praising so highly, I think we'll see a China that is deeply suspicious of the United States, deeply sees, you know, the whole process of that it is aimed at trying to put China ultimately under a siege through squeezing its energy supply routes. Venezuela was just the first. But of course, putting a blockade on Hormuz would be a blockade that could be used against China. Of course, in other areas, we're seeing Chinese shipping is being seized and arrested, and all of this is a siege. Same the opposite way around on Russia's exports. But I mean, corridors of energy, corridors of if you like, components for the economy, of supply lines. All of these things, America's trying to seize it and try and be in charge of it, particularly tech. And the rivalry there is becoming bitter as China introduces new AI models, cheaper. And what is more is you don't give up your data to them. You keep them in, you can protect your own data. You can just download them directly from China and start using them tomorrow. And it's going to, I think, revolutionize the AI. And of course, I mean, you know, for some in America, not all, of course, I know there's quite a strong movement that really does not like the Silicon Brothers taking over America either. And so China is moving fast. It sees a great threat to it from America, not the same threat that Iran is under, but a threat to try and sort of, if you like, undermine its economic growth, undermine its economy in the interests of stimulating the American economy. But it's not going to capitulate either.
And if it doesn't,
I assure you they're not going to.
And I think it's pretty clear that they won't. But what will this challenge that you're describing here and this interaction, how does it respond in China if the United States basically loses this war in the Middle East and loses a lot of the influence we have over Iraq or Iran oil or anything else? How does China emerge from that competition in any way?
Well, it doesn't have to. It's not much of a competition in the Middle East. Everyone will welcome China to the Middle East. Don't be under no illusions. Even the Gulf states, they will all be seeking, a new relationship with a bigger, bolder relationship with China and Russia. That's quite clear. And China will do it in terms which are reasonable for and not sort of colonialist, not exploitative, but they will provide infrastructure and money for development to states, and it will be closer. So the region will be absorbed into Asia. The Middle East will become a part of Greater Asia, and Greater Asia will be, China will, it doesn't want to lead it, but it will be one of the most important powers in this new structure. And Europe and America will be isolated.
Yeah,
and China's going to win.
That's what I'm worried about. And I'm sorry, we're running low on time, and I don't want to miss the second part here. If we have painted a pretty grim picture that, and again, I fully concur and argue that we have already lost the war with Iran, and all these ramifications of some version or another are going to come and manifest. It's not the only one. I argue that we have also already lost the war between Russia and Ukraine. And by that, this extension of we're just using Ukraine as a proxy. So by that one, we have also lost, because everything President Trump has tried to do in the war in a day, in the war in 100 days, and now he's just picked a side. He said with Secretary Rubio in June, and now then that cannot succeed. But that you wouldn't know that from listening to the supporters of President Trump on Western media. Here is what Senator McCormick had to say just yesterday.
The tide is turning against Vladimir Putin. For more than 4 years, Russia has waged a brutal, unprovoked war of aggression against a free and sovereign Ukraine. Putin bet that Kyiv would fall in days. He bet that the West would fracture in response. And when that didn't work, he bet that Ukraine would break in a few months. And he was wrong on every count. And today, he finds himself in a moment of weakness. President Trump promised peace through strength, and his strategy is working.
There you have that again, that peace through strength thing, and it's working. Do you agree?
I think it's not Putin that has been wrong on every count. It is the senator that is wrong on every count. Every comment he made, it was not, if you like, an unprovoked, illegal invasion of Ukraine. That is just the narrative which is stripped of context. It doesn't go back to what was happening before Maidan. It doesn't go back to the American absorption of the Galen Organization towards the end of the Second World War and how that affected American thinking about Russia. It strips all the context out and just has it as a flat assertion. And so they have this flat assertion. Anyone that disagrees with it must be wrong. But it just, if you like, by decontextualizing everything down to these rather absurd simplicities, they provoke and cause and come bring us close to a much bigger danger, because the way this is going, there will soon be an escalation by Russia against a close ally of the United States, against Europe. And this is, I believe, going to come sooner or later, because the Europeans insist on that they have been encouraged and have the backing of the United States to build, construct, design longer and longer range cruise missiles and drones to attack deeper into Russia and to attack things that are completely unrelated to the war effort. These attacks on the Wildberries warehouses. Wildberries is like Amazon. What would you say if, you know, the Russia started attacking Amazon warehouses? You'd say, what the hell is all this about? And that's a question that needs to be asked. So, I mean, what is the aim of this war? For America, that they say they're going to win. Well, we know, because it's the same aim that's been there for nearly 200 years, to break up Russia, to partition it into its separate component parts, and to steal its resources. We've seen it happen three times now, that war has been waged on Russia. I mean, the German war was one about empire, too, expanding its empire. It was envious of Britain. Britain had India and all the resources of the East, which it plundered and made itself rich. And then Britain started preparing for war against against Russia. And then even during the war, I mean, you know, you have to think what Russians feel about this, because even during the Second World War, when Russia was an ally fighting the Germans, at some point Britain was supposed to support Russia, provide assistance to Russia, who was stuck in Leningrad at that time. And what happened? Well, Churchill whispered to Roosevelt and he said, look, you know, maybe the reserves should be delayed in going there, because isn't it better that they just kill more of each other during this time? Isn't that better? And so, and then again, after the war, Churchill and Roosevelt signed this agreement afterwards to send everybody back to Stalin. There were Cossack units sent back whole, to be, you know, lined up and executed. He sent back millions, refused to allow them to stay anywhere, and they came to this agreement to send them back so that they could be tried and hooded and then executed for their betrayal of the Soviet Union. I mean, there were some desperate things. Do you think Russia doesn't know any of this history? Does it not know it? Does it really think that this whole war started suddenly on the date that Russia invaded Ukraine after the Kiev increased the attacks on Donbas by a factor of 17, the artillery shelling of the civilian areas of Donbas. It was obviously intended to provoke Russia into this attack in order to try and turn it into a NATO-wide conflict against Russia. But the Russians, I mean, you know, they know their history. I mean, unlike us, they do study history. They know their history. And so, you know, this is a bitter conflict. Long, many grudges, much ill feeling in it. But someone has to sit down. In my view, the first step was the first step actually that JFK took before he was assassinated. When he started to say, you know, we should acknowledge how much Russia lost fighting with us in the Second World War. How many men they lost, 27 million, how many people were lost in that. We should start from saying something like that. And I think it's the same. There has to be some sort of acknowledgement of the realities of what it is, not this sort of crude, childish, you know, simply sort of reducing everything to, you know, without any context to decontextualized world. Oh, Russia just, you know, came into Putin's head that he wanted to be an emperor again, and so he took part of Ukraine. I mean, this is the sort of stuff you wouldn't even get from a seven-year-old child writing an essay at school.
Right. So let me ask you, because, I mean, again, you're painting a very clear picture that we're not going to win. The task is just militarily unattainable, and yet economically and militarily we keep trying, but it's going to fail. What does that failure look like? And especially if you can't decouple it even from the loss that's coming in the Middle East, what is that going to do to NATO if, however this gets resolved, whether that's Russia taking even Kiev at some point in the future or whatever, what does that do to NATO? How does it come out of this war?
Well, I think it doesn't come out of this war. It's, I think, already fracturing, and it will be fractured further. It only stays together because, you know, this is what Brussels and NATO want, you know, to wave. I mean, because where did this Ukraine war come from the NATO perspective, was, you know, after the war on terror and everything, what was the purpose of NATO, you know, in the modern era? What was the purpose? What was it going to do? It wasn't going to fight terrorism forever. It hasn't made a good job of that. But what was it going to do? Ah, Ukraine. Yes, Russia. That's where we are. And, of course, under the Treaty of Lisbon, the European Union is obliged to follow the lead of NATO. It has no free choice in this. It's in the treaties. Don't forget, I worked for Secretary General of NATO, who was then the high representative of the European Union. And he told me very clearly, you know, European policy has to follow NATO policy. Now, some people in America think this has been a good thing for Europe. And maybe it has. Maybe, I mean, I know some people say, well, you know, it stopped the Europeans from fighting each other all the time. And that's, maybe there's some truth in it. But what it also did was to kill politics in Europe. It smothered real politics because everything had to be reduced to centrism, had to be reduced. You know, we have the cordon sanitaire. That is, you know, you're not allowed to ally with, talk to the far right. Now it's also the far left. They say you can't talk to just the center, and the center has to follow NATO, follow. And as the ground in Europe, as the people start to explode from the contradictions in the economy that they, you know, they can't live on what they're given. While the elites float off on the boondoggle of NATO and new conferences and more money for more buildings, but for 90% of the population, it doesn't trickle down. And since you can't protest and you can't vote against it, what do? You get more and more angry at the elites and more angry at NATO. And you argue, it'll be, get rid of NATO, get NATO out. We don't want it. That will be the mood on the street, I predict, in Europe, the consequence of this war.
I couldn't possibly disagree with you. I mean, the logic you lay out is ironclad. I mean, we see the trends moving in that direction right now. I wish we had more time to go down this path. I look forward to having you back on next time and send people to Conflicts Forum so they can see more things from Alistair Crook here, because, man, we just can't get enough of it. Pretty sobering conclusions here. But again, people need to know the truth and not go after this nonsense that they keep hearing on these mainstream media, like we just played a second ago. And although that's actually from the Senate floor, but we now know the truth, and we really appreciate you bringing it. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me to speak.
And by the way, we're going to have Glenn Deason back here in about a minute and a half. So look to that link on our channel, and we will see you there with Glenn in just a few minutes. And then at 1 o'clock, we have Ambassador Chaz Freeman back. Always a delight to hear from him as well. We'll see you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.